Well, Peter, thank you so much for joining us. It's a special edition of Off the Hour. We want to look at kind of an inside view of the detention centers that are near Montreal. Can you describe for us the detention center that's the closest to the city, the one that you've been visiting as a volunteer with Action on Refugee?
There are several places where people can be detained near Montreal. There's the border or in the airports. Usually they're just detained for short periods. But the main detention facility is in Laval, and it's near the old prisons there. I think the old prison is Saint-Vincent or something like that, the old Laval detention center. Technically, it's not a detention center. It's a prevention center. They're quite sticky about that.
Prevention of what?
Prevention of, well, we could talk about what they're trying to prevent after, but they're not actually incarcerated, right? So they're not there for a sentence. And the idea of a detention center is that you're there for a sentence, and they're not criminals. Even immigration recognizes that to a certain extent. It holds anywhere from, I mean, I guess the facility can hold up to probably over 100 people. This summer, the most we've had has been 110. Usually, it goes anywhere from, there are anywhere from 40 to, say, 70 or 80 people there. Like all summer, we've had at least 70 or 80 for most of the summer so far. There's one section for the women, and the men's section is separate. And they're usually probably about three times as many men as there are women at any given time, sometimes more. There are usually a lot more men. Then there's a separate section where minors and families will be held in and the minors will actually be held sort of in a separate area. And if there's only one minor, then they're held in isolation, which is kind of difficult for some of them. I mean, they'll just be by themselves in a room with a TV. The men's side has, it looks like a prison. I mean, it's not, you go in and you get searched, you get the metal detectors and whatnot. And most people can only go into, there's an area for visitors, and they'll bring the detainees out to the visitors area. We have an agreement with Immigration Canada that we go into the common area. There's sort of a common area where the men, there are a couple of ping pong tables and where people play dominoes and whatnot. And so, and usually there'll be 20 or 30 men. And that's what, sort of where they hang out when they're not in their rooms during the winter, when they only go outside for half an hour a day. But in the summer, they're spending more time outside because the whole place isn't air conditioned and they don't even have fans up in the rooms. And so it's stifling. The heat is, like, during the heat wave, it was just terrible in there. I mean, the heat. And so now they're trying to keep them, let them outside as much as possible, where there's like a little enclosure with the big barbed wire and razor wire around it and whatnot. I mean, it really has the feeling of a prison.
Well, there's this image of Canada as a place with open arms for immigrants to come to. It's a country that it's seen its population grow through its kind of immigration policy. Why are these people there rather than going through the normal processes for immigration? Why are they actually being detained in these centers?
As far as Canada being a place with open arms, I mean, the problem with Canada is that we often look good by comparison. I mean, so in comparison to Australia or the States or to France, things look pretty good here, relatively speaking. I mean, we don't have concentration camps in the desert, and, you know, those types of things. The reasons that people are detained when they arrive, there are four basic reasons that people can be that people will be detained in the detention center. One of them is if the immigration officers think they're not going to show up for their hearing or their deportation or whatever it is, that they'll have, if they have reason to believe that they're not going to show up when they're supposed to leave or when they're supposed to be there for their hearing. The second reason is if they can't ascertain their identity, which is a big problem especially for refugees who are fleeing oppressive regimes or places where it's just the whole bureaucracy is broken down. And, you know, to get documentation, you know, a valid passport, especially if you're poor, if you're fleeing a really difficult situation, you won't always have the proper documentation. And people from certain areas or certain countries will be detained for identity purposes a lot more than people from other countries. And For example, we have a lot of people from Pakistan right now who are detained for identity purposes because they, you know, immigration doesn't believe who they are or doesn't believe their documentation. The same thing with people who flee, you know, people who aren't going to show up. People from certain countries are considered more a risk, a flight risk than others. For example, Chinese migrants will be detained almost routinely on arrival and have to post huge bonds to be released, while people from other countries won't face those. They're different. I mean, technically, it's not in the regulations, or it's officially, that's not the official policy, but from what we've seen, that's sort of the practice, is that there's different people from Costa Rica are almost automatically detained on arrival, especially if they make a refugee claim. That's pretty much a one-way ticket into the detention center. While other countries, you know, it sort of depends on where you're from and, you know, what social class you're from and those things as well. The third reason is if you're considered a danger to society or a danger to the public, which could mean for reasons of criminality. Under the new law, that means if you're involved in people smuggling in any way, in other words, if you've helped somebody get across the border illegally in any way, you're pretty, you qualify as a danger to the public. Obviously, the new terrorism, the whole fear around September 11th and whatnot plays into that danger to the public as well. It's sort of a more difficult thing to define, but the minister can just define somebody as a danger to the public, and it's very hard to contest that afterwards because they can present. Under the new law, they can present evidence that wouldn't be admissible in a court. But you that then can be used by the judge to decide that you're a danger to the public and that you can be detained or deported on those grounds. And the same thing where you'll even have cases now under the laws that have come in since September 11th, where you might not even be able to see the evidence that shows that you're a danger to the public. And also any sort of association with organized crime or drug trafficking. They sort of have specific offenses that they have lists. There's sort of specific offenses that pretty much automatically constitute you a danger to the public. And any sort of association with drug trafficking or production, even in your own country. So even if you were a coca farmer in Colombia or in Brazil, that would be grounds for considering you a danger to the public here. And then the final reason is for administrative convenience. And that is new, and that didn't exist before. And they just brought in a new immigration law on June 28th. Under the new immigration law, you can be detained for administrative convenience, which basically means to continue the examination. Before, they had to have grounds under one of the other grounds I just mentioned. I mean, identity, that you're going to flee and you're not going to show up, or that you're a danger to the public, to be able to continue the examination or to detain you. Now, just to continue, if they feel that they need to detain you to be able to continue their examination, then you can be detained. We're not sure how that's actually going to play out because we haven't actually seen it. It's only been 2 weeks that the new law has been in effect, and so we haven't really seen how some of these things are going to play out in practice. But that's the fourth reason under the new law.
Well, the law that went into effect on June 28th, perhaps you can break that down for our listeners, and maybe also describe what's the word inside of the detention center. How are people understanding these laws that their lives are, you know, being so much affected by?
Well, actually, I just yesterday sent a fax to Immigration Canada to get them to give copies of the laws to the people in the detention center, because right now they don't even know what the law is. They don't have access to the law. They don't have copies. I mean, they don't have internet access or any of that. So really, a lot of it is just what their lawyers have time to tell them, which isn't usually a lot. I mean, the lawyers will explain a little bit, but a legal aid lawyer doesn't have a lot of time to spend explaining the law to people, and which is a reality of most of the people in the detention center are people who are getting legal aid lawyers. I mean, they're overwhelmingly poor people who can't afford lawyers. If you can afford a high-priced lawyer, chances are you'd never end up in the detention center in the first place. And even if you did, you'd be out pretty quickly. Because you'd be able to post a huge bond or whatever it is that they'd want. I spent some time trying to explain, you know, the new laws. We're just trying to figure it out ourselves. And so people are quite, you know, don't really understand how the new laws are working or what the new laws are. Certain parts of it are very similar to the old laws. Some things have changed. For example, the amount of time between detention revisions has changed, which has a significant impact, for example, on people from Pakistan, where now you get a hearing after 48 hours of detention, another one a week later, and then after that, if they still have grounds to detain you, you get a revision every 30 days. And so if you need to get documentation from Pakistan, and let's say that after your first hearing, after 48 hours, they say, okay, we need this, this, and this, your school certificate or whatever it is that they want, is that there's no way you're going to get that couriered here in a week. So you're automatically looking at another 37 days because you're not going to have it by the next hearing, which will be a week from then. And so you're going to wait 30 days for the hearing after that to be able to be, so that you can be released. While before there were more 7-day hearings, like you had hearings every week for the first, I think it was the first month or something like that. I mean, or at least the first two or three times. And so the times between your detention reviews have been extended, which means people will be spending more time in the detention center. There are definitely some things that have changed in the new law, between the new law and the old law, that'll make it more difficult. In terms of, for example, your refugee hearing, you're only going to get one adjudicator rather than three adjudicators, which you used to have the right to have three adjudicators before, and now you're assigned one adjudicator. In other words, if you fall on a bad adjudicator, then you're pretty much SOL. While before you'd at least have three adjudicators, and you'd have the right to have the three people. Changes in terms of the actual process. There was supposed to be a refugee appeal board, like a creation of an appeal within the refugee system, so that refugees would automatically get an appeal on the merits of their case. That the government has decided, and that was one of the reasons that a lot of advocacy groups sort of said, okay, well, the new law is good in some ways and bad in others. I mean, it was sort of a, you know, like, is it worse than the other law? In some ways it is, in some ways it isn't. I mean, it's tougher in some ways, but at least we've got the appeal board. We've got you get the appeal on the merits of your case, which you never used to get. It was very hard to win appeals before because you really had to show that something in the process had gone wrong. So, like, the court wouldn't look at the merits of your case. The court would just look if, you, for example, you didn't get heard, or you didn't get, like, something in terms of the actual process went wrong, or they didn't follow the rules in the process. But the court wouldn't look at the actual merits of the case. Well, the idea was that they were going to have this appeal board and all the refugees would have the right to an appeal. And just before, I guess it was about a month before the new law was going to come into effect, the government decided that they're not going to implement it. Maybe next year, maybe the year after that, they're going to implement. But right now, for logistical reasons and financial reasons, and we're not very clear why, basically they just don't have. They decided they're not going to implement it, and which sort of leaves a bit of a hole in the law in terms of the way that we understood it, because we've been looking at the law since November. And we were always trying to understand the law in terms of with this appeal board in it. And now they've just sort of taken this chunk out of the law. And so we're trying to figure out what that means in terms of the actual functioning of the new law. Those are some of the changes. I mean, I guess I'm getting kind of technical in terms of legal stuff. But
well, I think that's what's needed, because it seems like the folks on the inside obviously don't have the information. And it's not something that the mainstream media is talking about, these changes in immigration policy. There have been some coverage in the Montreal Gazette of Lacolle border crossing, of the hundreds of people coming through there, knowing that the law was going to change on June 28th, trying to get in before the law changed, thinking that it would make a difference in their case, when in fact it hadn't made any sort of difference.
In maybe 5% of the cases of the people who came to the border in Lacolle, it would have actually made a difference. One of the significant changes in the new law is that refugees can't remake. You can't get a second, make a second refugee application, even if your first application was 20 years ago, and the situation has changed in your country or whatever. You can't make a second refugee application if you've been refused or you desisted from an application in the past. You don't get a second chance. Which under the old law, if you left Canada for 90 days, you could come back and make a second and make another application. And so there were a lot of people in the States who were thinking, oh, well, we need to come back. And some people who had been living underground for a long time in the States said, okay, this is our last chance. Let's go. And then they've arrived here and realized that it's like, some of them, that some of the people that we've talked to probably would have been better off just staying in the States. You're already established to a certain extent. I mean, you've got some kind of support network there. And so, arriving here, and now they end up in the detention center where they'll probably end, some of them will most probably be end up deported back to their home countries. But for those people, it did make a difference. I think there was also some confusion around the Safe Third Country Agreement, there was some confusion, especially in the Pakistani community, for some reason that went out in terms of the through the grapevine that the Safe Third Country Agreement was coming into effect on June 28th, and that seems to have motivated a lot of people to come up, because what the Safe Third Country Agreement means is that the first country that you arrive in is the country where you have to make your refugee claim, and if between the countries that have the Safe Third Country Agreement. So, for example, if you arrive in the United States and you can't come to Canada and make a refugee, or if you arrive in the United States, say from Pakistan, you can't come to Canada and make a refugee claim. If you come to Canada and make a refugee claim, you'll be sent back to the United States to make your claim there. And obviously there are laws, especially since 96, when they brought in a new immigration law in the States, the refugee and immigration laws are a lot tougher in the States than they are in Canada. It's a lot more difficult to make a refugee claim. Not to mention, I mean, the States is also not a signatory, one of the few countries on the planet that hasn't signed the Geneva Convention on refugees, along with umpteen other treaties that they haven't signed. But, there are 160 countries or something like that that have signed the convention on refugees, and the United States is one of the few that hasn't, and so they will be sent back. And about 60% of the refugees who arrive in Canada arrive through the United States, because a lot of places, for example, from Africa, there are very few direct flights to Canada from Africa, so you have to go either through London or New York, and if you fly through New York, you'll be sent back to the States. And so we don't have a Safe Third Country Agreement with Great Britain yet. There'd be no reason for Great Britain to do that. There's no advantage for the States. And we're trying to understand why the States would have made this agreement. We're thinking it's probably going to be implemented sometime in the fall. Hopefully we're going to get some warning as to before it'll actually start being implemented. But for now, it hasn't been. It was signed at the G8 summit. It was signed in principle or whatever was announced during the G8 summit in Kananaskis. But we still don't have a final text.
But groups like Amnesty International have already spoken out against it, because if you are going to be bouncing refugees back to the United States under this third safe country agreement, they're critical of the United States and its refugee and immigration policy, somewhat that you have touched on, not only not signing the Geneva Convention on Refugees, but also some of the other what they call just plain illegal statutes that they have in their immigration and refugee policy. What is it about Canadian immigration? What's the driving force? Who's influencing this policy? And why have we seen so many changes within the last year or so?
The thing is, the reality, this has been a long time coming. A change in the immigration law, and most advocates have been advocating for major changes. The immigration system in Canada has been broken for a long time, and I don't think anybody's on either side of, whether advocates for immigrant organizations or anti-immigration groups. Nobody thinks the system as it was was functioning properly. I mean, there were all kinds of problems in terms of the way the system is working that were causing, I mean, even just in terms of delays, in terms of the complexity and the bureaucracy and all this, the problems that were going on inside, within the system. And so those changes weren't actually brought about by September. It wasn't after September 11th. The law was in the works a long time before that. Now, the Safe Third Country Agreement is something that sort of came up since September 11th. That's been, and it's actually a surprise to us. Well, not a surprise to us in terms of trying to figure out what it is that the United States is actually getting out of this, because it's not to their advantage in terms of they're going to end up dealing with 60% of the refugees who normally would come to Canada from, like, the refugees, like, of the refugees who actually arrive on our shores. Like, there's a portion of the refugees that come to Canada that are pre-approved in countries, in, for example, in association with the UNHCR, the UN High Commission on Refugees, which, you know, will, in, for example, be in a place like Rwanda or Sierra Leone, and in the refugee camps will say, these people are refugees, and then will pre-approve, and Canada will say, okay, we'll accept 1,000 or 2,000 or whatever, and they'll get, and then those, a certain number of people will be pre-approved. And then there's the refugees who actually arrive in Canada and make claims here. Of those, most of them come through the States. Now, what this means is that all those people will be sent back, and then we'll make refugee claims in the States, which means that the American system is going to have to deal with them, which is going to put an, I mean, in terms of the total number of refugees that come into the States, it's not like it's going to double their numbers or anything like that. I mean, we're still talking probably less than 10% of the refugees who arrive in the States. But it is going to, you know, they are taking on a lot more work. Obviously, it probably has to do with the whole idea of the security perimeter, the idea that people are coming, the fear that people are coming down, you know, that Canada has this lax refugee policy. I mean, we do accept a lot more refugees in terms of per capita and the number of people here. And the idea is that obviously the States want to be able to close down their borders, and this is a way for them to be able to influence our immigration policy in terms of, rather than clamping down the border at the Canadian border, this is a way of sort of stopping the amount of refugees that come in through Canada by stopping them at the American border and letting us send them back. And then a lot of them will just get sent back to their home countries and be detained in the States, because refugees are detained in the States during their whole process in the States. While here, that's not the case. I mean, people will often be, for the most part, will be allowed to work and go to school and whatnot while they're awaiting their refugee determinations, that's the way that things are it's supposed to work in the Geneva Convention, but in the States that's not really the way it works.
Talking about this human beings being sent back and being detained and such, you just never hear capital talked about in these terms, and that's one of the reasons the international border camp is opening up today in Strasbourg, France, is to oppose this kind of idea that, you know, goods and capital can move freely across borders, but people are objects to be detained, objects to be imprisoned, objects to be sent back to countries where their lives are threatened. You had just mentioned that the immigration policy that Canada is currently operating on, and just instated in June, on June 28th, was in shape before September 11th. In the news and in the mainstream media, do you see a kind of shift in rhetoric towards immigrants and refugees since September 11th?
I think there definitely has been a shift in terms of just the portrayals of who we need to be afraid of, or who are we letting into the country. And every time that there's, you know, an arrest or something in the States, and any time there's a connection with Canada, with any kind of terrorist group or terrorist organization, or, you know, and it's obviously the organizations that get defined as terrorist, or that get defined as, you know, it's always certain ethnic communities. It's always certain types of organizations, and with certain religious, we're looking at Muslims, usually Arab, is the sort of associations that go along with that. While in terms of the actual, I guess we see that come across in the media, in some media more blatantly than in others. I mean, like, for example, the Gazette is much worse than, or the National Post, in my experience, have been a lot worse than the French, like a lot of the French newspapers, in particular La Presse or Le Devoir, where, because of the communities that are served by those papers, I think to a certain extent in Montreal, and in other places as well, and the people who own those papers. I mean, Izzy Asper's papers have been a lot worse in terms of their portrayal of immigrant communities, especially immigrants from certain, you know, from certain places or from certain ethnic groups, than have, you know, some other people's papers or the mainstream, other forms of mainstream media, like whether it's the CBC. I mean, just between the CBC and Global, for example. I think the influence of the American media is huge here, and I don't think that we can get around that. And I think that that's been a big part of where we've seen a change in the rhetoric coming from the United States, is that I've seen anyways, is a lot of the rhetoric coming from the United States and you know, through CNN or whatever, which is the constant barrage of terrorism and the fears, and not just the fear of what's actually happened or what's actually happening, but also there's a lot of the fiction, like the what ifs, and the what if scenarios always involve the same people, and yet the what ifs, you know, we didn't see so much of the, like, for example, after the Oklahoma bombing, we didn't see the same kinds of what if scenarios. We didn't see this constant variety, because really there's only been one major attack in the States. I mean, is that, and not to say that there's, like, not to minimize that attack, but I mean, it obviously had a very significant impact on American society in all kinds of ways. But it's one, it was one attack. But there's been a year, I mean, since then, there's just been this constant barrage, and not just in terms of the what-if scenarios in the media, but also from Hollywood, from all these other, I mean, we see all these, the movies, and just the whole culture of fear around biological weapons, nuclear weapons, and all these things that actually haven't happened. And I think that there's definitely an impact here in terms of the collective fear is of these, you know, Middle Eastern immigrants coming in and blowing things up or whatnot. And I think that that fear does play out in terms of who ends up. And we look in the detention center, and, you know, those are the people who end up. I mean, who end up in the detention centers.
Well, the last time the United States and Canada engaged in a war in Kosovo, there was a mass of refugees that had come to North America, and they had been received with open arms and were taking on shopping trips and, you know, offered all kinds of ways to have the American-Canadian experience while they were here. But we didn't hear much about refugees from Afghanistan. In fact, when I was able to talk with someone about a situation of refugees in Afghanistan not receiving the kind of welcome that refugees from Kosovo received, it was actually at Woomera in Australia. And the situation there, we've talked about on Off the Hour before, is that there's this huge detention center in the middle of a desert surrounded by uranium mines. There's no plant life, no animals, and some of these individuals have been in there for 3 years, and children have been born there and such. And I had the opportunity to ask one of the activists who had participated in an action in which they tore down the fence in March at Woomera in Australia, what it was like for refugees coming from Kosovo and what it was like for these refugees coming from Afghanistan, and if there had been much of a difference, you know, telling her the Canadian-American experience here. And it was the same thing there, you know. Refugees from Kosovo were received with open arms in Australia. They were taken out to play soccer. They were taken out to the malls on the weekend. and had a completely different experience than these refugees from Afghanistan who were penned in inside of a detention center in a toxic desert. Why is there this difference in treatment for refugees coming from a place like Kosovo or refugees coming from a place like Afghanistan?
The color of their skin would probably be the top one on my list as far as the reason. I mean, most of the refugees from Kosovo, I mean, not all, but most of the refugees from Kosovo were white. The attitudes that people have toward immigrants from Eastern Europe, for some reason there's a belief that it's easier to integrate, or that it's, for example, from Russia or from other places like that. While, you know, it's not like the criminality is in terms of connections to violent organizations, they're just as much, the chances are just as high, if not higher, that someone from, for example, Russia or from some certain Eastern European countries would be associated with violent organizations than someone from Costa Rica or Colombia. And I think that's one of the distinctions that, you know, like someone from Colombia may have been part of a violent organization. Let's say, I mean, if somebody was involved in one of the guerrillas there or something like that, the chances that a guerrillero from Colombia is going to getting engage in violent action here is unheard of. I mean, we don't know of any cases where that's happened, where the FARC has, for example, has blown up a building or has attacked or assassinated people here. And yet to say that they're different, I mean, someone from Bosnia, it's not like we speak the same, like the language is different, the culture is different, there still are all those differences, and it doesn't make communication any easier. And, you know, for example, there are probably better chances that someone from India speaks English quite fluently than someone from one of the Baltic republics or from and yet there's this idea that it's going to be easier for them to integrate into Canadian society. The one factor that seems to come across the two factors are race and religion, and I think that those are, you know, to answer your question, I mean that's where I think that's where the big distinctions come in, and the illusion that Canada is not a racist society, and I think that's something that we really try to maintain in not only in our own heads, but also just in terms of, you know, the government and the, you know, we try to maintain this mythology of Canada not being a racist society, and I think that it's examples like the one that you brought up that really highlight a lot of the racism within Canada. And I mean, the detention center is a perfect example of that. I mean, it's not reflective of the racial makeup of Canadian society, or even the racial makeup of the people coming in, of newly arrived immigrants into Canadian society.
Well, let's talk about that. You had mentioned the rhetoric is that Canada is not a racist society, that its immigration policy is not racist. But what is the ethnic makeup inside of the detention centers that you're visiting just outside of Montreal?
The vast majority are people of color. We do see some people from Eastern Europe. It also depends. I mean, there's sort of in waves from different places where we'll have more. Like right now, there are a lot of people from Pakistan and different regions of Africa. Sometimes there'll be large numbers of people from Latin America. Right now, there are only four or five people from Latin America. But in general, your chances are much higher of being detained, depending on which country you're from. And the southern countries are usually highest on the list, and yet that's not an official policy, and Immigration Canada would never recognize that as an official policy. And I think that's where a lot of our that sort of unspoken racial profiling and unspoken racism, and a lot of it happens with a very, you know, with a smiling face and and the facade from Immigration Canada. I mean, you go to the front desks in Immigration Canada and you'll see a very, you know, diverse mix of, you know, people from different races and different ethnic backgrounds. The higher up you get in Immigration Canada, and, you know, the minister is a middle-aged, white, privileged male. And so, and he's representative of the top tier of Immigration Canada, the head of the Immigration and Refugee Board, the heads of the different sections. And then as you move down further, you'll start seeing more, a few more women, and then a few more people of color as you start. Then the further down you move until you get to the actual front lines. For example, down at the Guy Favreau complex, half the people working there will be people of color. And so you get that, those kinds of, and it's a question of maintaining that, that's going to maintain the illusion, because people are never going to get to the director's office. It's not necessarily an overt racism that's built, but it's sort of built into the system in terms of, even in terms of the criteria of, you know, who's accepted as an immigrant, who can afford a lawyer, who can afford, I mean, all these things, who can actually move around, who's actually ever going to get onto the plane in the first place. All these factors come into and form a sort of systemic racism and a systemic, I mean, the same thing with gender issues. The vast majority of the people in the detention center we see are men, because most of the women most of the refugees who will make it onto Canadian soil to make a refugee claim here will be men, because women will end up in for example, if you're a woman in a country in, let's say, Africa, where you've got two or three children, trying to get out and trying to make it to Canada, I mean, you already have to be of a certain, there has to be a certain amount of privilege to be able to get your travel documents, to be able to take off, is that, and I mean, this is something that a lot of studies have shown. I mean, the studies of who can actually be mobile enough to escape the countries that they need to escape, and most of those people will be men, just because of the privileges in those societies as well.
On June 26th, there's going to be this demonstration here in Montreal, because there are 1,000 Algerians right here in our community that are facing deportation because of a policy shift within immigration. Can you maybe explain a little bit about this policy change and what it means to be non-status? These are non-status refugee claimants, some of whom have been here for 8 years, who are now facing deportation back to Algeria, for some of whom, if when they get there, their lives will be in serious danger.
Canada has a list of countries that are on moratorium. It's a moratorium on deporting people to certain countries, which basically means that even if their refugee claims have been refused, they're considered, or they're immigrant, you know, for whatever reason, these people are set to be deported. There are certain countries that are considered too dangerous to deport people to. Now, it's a bit of a contradiction in terms to say that you're not a refugee, but your country is too dangerous for you to be sent back to. Essentially, what it means is that people who are, you know, and there are a few countries on, you know, like, for example, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Afghanistan, would be other other countries that are on the moratorium. I think Colombia might still be on the list as well. But where people aren't deported, we don't deport people to those places. And while the country's on the moratorium list, people's refugee claim, you know, they'll make their refugee claims, they get rejected. And then you end up in a sort of legal limbo, where you have no status in Canada. You can't work, you know, you can maybe get a work permit. I mean, they have in practice been giving people work permits, but you have to pay for your work permit. But I mean, you don't have the right to social assistance, medical care, schooling. You can't study here. There are a whole list of things that you can't do, which you can do when you're in the process of making a refugee claim, for example, where you know you would have, you know, your children go to school, you have access, you could go to university, you could study at college or whatever. And so a lot of the people, like Algeria was on the list for a long time, and it was just recently when Prime Minister Chrétien went on his tour of Africa, and you know, on his with Team Canada or whatever,
the business trip.
Which, you know, and of course they did come back with millions of dollars of contracts from, like, with Algeria, because things are okay in Algeria. Business is good. Business is great. And, you know, I mean, granted, you know, 600 or 800 people have died so far this year in the violence that's ongoing in Algeria. But we can set that aside because, you know, business is good and that doesn't really affect. So we can take them off the moratorium list because the Algerian government really isn't so bad. I mean, look how good we're getting along. And so that's sort of what's happened from the side of the government. They've lifted the moratorium, but over the years, I mean, this moratorium has been in effect for, I think, almost 10 years that they've had a moratorium on sending people back to Algeria, is that a lot of people have been non-status here for a long time, and they've been in Canada for a number of years without status. And when we talked to Immigration Canada came and talked to the Table de Concertation, which is a sort of grouping of all the, like once a month, all the organizations that do support work for refugees and immigrants get together just to talk about the situation and whatnot. And there's usually a representative from Immigration Canada who comes and gets grilled on whatever the issues of the day are. When he was talking about Algeria, he was saying, well, listen, we're not, you know, going to run out and start arresting all these people tomorrow and deporting 1,000 people all at once. Because obviously that would create a huge political problem for them. But in the next, you know, so they're going to start off with the least desirables, which means, you know, the people who have criminal records, the people who are considered undesirable for all sorts of reasons. And then they sort of have a hierarchy of who's going to get sent back over the next, you know, year or so. We'll probably start seeing people in the detention centers. Right now, there are like one or two people from Algeria in the detention center.
You mentioned this, you know, it's being good for business with Algeria, and so we have to change our moratorium policy to kind of comply with that. We've also talked about the kind of phobias that exist in the mainstream consciousness towards certain immigrants or refugees of color, fears and xenophobia. What is it that that guides the kind of situations that you see unfolding in front of you when you visit in the detention centers? Do you see the results of you know, racist immigration policy? Do you see the results of just good for business playing out there in terms of the people that you're dealing with?
I think for me it's how much of it is Immigration Canada and how much of it is just a general situation. It's a situation that goes far beyond Immigration Canada. I mean, there is a global situation in which we have extremely poor countries that are exploited by extremely rich countries. Canada is one of those extremely rich countries and is totally complicit in what goes on in the poor countries on the planet. However, I don't think that Immigration Canada is in and of itself, like I don't think that it's just Immigration Canada that is responsible for that whole situation, because I think that if we were to change, you know, just completely open up the borders, not only would the Canadian population react in a very negative way, and I don't think that I think that those policies come about for all kinds of broader reasons, and I think that the problems are with the borders and with the structure of nation states that we have. And yes, we do see that play out in terms of in the detention center of who ends up there, who ends up trying to come to Canada, who ends up trying to escape from their countries, who ends up trying to get away, and why are they trying to come to Canada? And what is the privilege that, you know, the because of the privileges and the that are associated with being able to make it to Canada, people are willing to take enormous risks and, you know, to get here. But the people who will be sent back obviously come from certain countries. You know, there are certain countries that people want to escape for all kinds of really valid reasons. And we talk a lot about the mobility of capital, and we don't talk about the mobility of people, because we don't want people to be mobile. We don't want labor. We want labor to be caught in Indonesia or to be stuck in you know, so that there are pools of cheap labor. Because if the pools of cheap labor could move around at will, then the pools of cheap labor would dissipate and erode a lot of the privileges that that people here, that your average person in Canada has, which is an enormous amount of privilege. I mean, even minimum wage in Canada is an enormously privileged situation in terms of global wages, not to minimize what that means in terms of living in Canada or trying to raise a family on minimum wage, but those privileges are defended by the policies of immigration, are defended by closing the borders, and also by the same policies also create the pools of cheap labor that allow us to pick our vegetables and, I mean, we not, or to take care of, you know, whether it's childcare or whether it's the cheap restaurants or whether it's the cheap vegetables that we have in Canada or the cleaning that goes, a lot of which is done by undocumented and illegal non-status labor in Canada, not to the same extent where, I mean, for example, in California, the economy would collapse without illegal labor. And the fruits and vegetables that we eat coming from there, which a lot of what we eat here comes from illegal labor that we see in Mexico. And so in terms of saying those racist policies, I think that we do see that play out in the detention center. The more I see it function, the less I attribute it to the individuals who are in Immigration Canada, and the people who decide to take on a job working with immigrants day in, day out, tend to be, or my experience is that they're not necessarily the most, a lot of them come in with some really good intentions and do their jobs and it's a very difficult place to be. You know what I mean? It's a very difficult situation to be placed in, and to say that it's, or to try and figure out where the actual problem lies is actually quite difficult from my perspective. And a lot of it comes down to, you know, the new law, for example. A lot of the lobbying that went on with that law came from places like the Alliance Party, Western Canada, where you see much more, but where you'll have a lot less of the immigrants, where we're suffering the brunt, or that the immigrants here, we'll see in the detention centers in Montreal and Toronto, will actually suffer the brunt of immigration policies that are pandering to interests in the interior or of Canada, or in places where we don't, that we'll never really see the effects of what they're lobbying and what their fears. And a lot of that racism is actually not not really played out by the people who work in the detention centers or who are there, but that those policies get implemented by, not to stereotype the racist elements of, like, you know, that there are certain racist elements of Canadian society and there are other elements that aren't. But I think it's complicated for me to try to figure out where the problem lies.
Where exactly does the problem lie? If it is that ambiguous, then what are Canadians to do as citizens, many of whom have had immigrant experiences, whether it's their own being an immigrant or a refugee or their grandparents or their parents? What are they to do if they are to influence and try to change and shape and cultivate an immigration policy that accepted their grandparents when they came? You know, if two generations back were facing the same kind of immigration policy that we have today, many of the Canadians that are experiencing this kind of privileged lifestyle that we have wouldn't be in that situation. They might still be sitting in a detention center, or they might not have ever been set foot on Canadian soil. So if it is that kind of ambiguous to point to where the problem is, it's not the individual worker in Immigration Canada. There's obvious problems with the law, but there are these underlying assumptions that are in Immigration Canada that aren't, you know, necessarily coming from individuals, but just assumptions made towards people of color, people coming from Colombia or Afghanistan. What is it that Canadians can what are they able to do to shape this in such a way that it's as favorable, that the law that we have now is as favorable as it was when their grandparents came to this country, if anything?
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to challenging challenging racist attitudes and anti-immigrant attitudes when we experience them, and when we see those attitudes. The reality is that most immigrants will end up in the major metropolitan centers, at least when they first arrive, especially immigrants of color. And so when, you know, people arrive here, you know, in Montreal, in Toronto, in Vancouver, there isn't the same, the atmosphere is not the same. I mean, these are people who, like, you know, if you go to a high school in downtown Toronto, chances are you've grown up, you know, you've gone to elementary school, you've gone to high school, whether you're a white Canadian or whether you're a person of color, you've gone to school with people from all kinds of ethnic backgrounds, all kinds of, I mean, that kind of experience is there. And I think that's a lot of what helps to play down those, or to dissipate those fears. And I think that as long as the people in power feel that they have to play to those fears, or that they have to, because if all of a sudden you have a lot of people, I don't know how to, in terms of changing the policies.
Or influencing.
In influencing the policies. It's in influencing the people. I mean, challenging the more anti-immigrant and racist attitudes of places, like, for example, the Alliance Party, which has some very overtly, more anti-immigrant rhetoric in what they're, you know, what they're talking about, like they're, what they propose. But also the sort of underlying assumptions in the Liberal government's policies of them being careful to, you know, play the way that they're playing things is, you know, they're trying to make certain everybody happy. And their perception of what's going to make people happy comes down to us actually challenging the people around us and saying, well, listen, no, you don't have any reason to be afraid of people. And what does it mean for us to be living in the kind of privilege that we have? Is that, and I think that the reality is, and I think that that's one of the things that we need to recognize, is that if we open up our borders, we will lose our privilege. And I think that that's something that we're not going to try to convince people that opening up the borders is going to be good for them, because and I think because that fear is well founded, because we are screwing people over. Is that we're not going to give up our privilege without giving up our privilege. You know what I mean? It's not like we're going to. Is that we live in an extremely privileged position in terms of the world, and that is reinforced by an enormous military empire just to the south of us that defends us and that maintains those terms of the terms on which resources flow into Canada. And the resources flow into Canada not just in terms of the actual physical resources, but also in terms of the brain drain. In that we let countries in the so-called third world or in southern countries, put all the resources into educating people, and then say, okay, we only want people with PhDs, or we only want people with, you know, we'll take your scientists, we'll take your nurses, we'll take your doctors, and look how you can't take care of yourselves. And then here, then people arrive here, and then, you know, look, we've even got, I mean, even my taxi driver has a PhD. You know what I mean? Well, because then we won't recognize the doctor when they arrive here, because it's, well, you're not actually a doctor in Canada, but, you know, here you can, that's a lot of what's going on, but that maintains our privilege. You know what I mean? That's a lot of what maintains this, the status of life, like the way that we manage to live our lives here. And radically changing those policies is going to make a much more open and I think that there are a lot of positive things that will come from that would come from opening up borders and allowing free movement of people and things like that. But our economic privilege is not one of them. And I think that that's one of the main attitudes that we need to break down, is immigration only valid if it's good for the economy? And is the economy the sort of measuring stick that we should be measuring everything by in terms of what do we actually want to measure the worth of a society from? And if we're measuring it from in terms of economics, then we have a very efficient immigration policy. And racism is efficient in those terms, is that it will be systemically racist and it will be systemically prejudiced towards, it'll be especially classist. I mean, that goes without saying, in terms of, yes, the rich and the powerful are always going to be welcome here. If you've got $1 million, come on by. No problem. Now, who has $1 million? Just that in and of itself would create a systemically racist system. In terms of who has $1 million, you're already looking at a certain, you know, like the proportions of people who'll have that will be from certain racial backgrounds. And so that's where a lot of what we see in Canadian immigration policy, I don't think it's necessarily it's not someone sitting down and saying, okay, we only want to have we don't want to let people of certain racial backgrounds or of certain ethnic backgrounds in. It's a question of saying, okay, well, you know, immigration has to conform to certain, you know, economic goals, certain political goals, and also with the United States and other, you know, our relationships with other countries and whatnot.
For a general overview of the detention centers here and also the ins and outs of Canadian immigration policy, I think it's a great question to end on. Do we want to measure our immigration policy by its economic efficiency? Thank you so much, Peter, for joining us.